As always, thanks for listening in today to our Friday broadcast of Abiding in the Word with Dave Love, Senior Pastor of Calvary Castle Rock. Today we will be continuing our study in Exodus, so let's join Pastor Dave now.
Soon your trials will be over.
So Joshua falls to his face, worships the Lord, then he's told to remove his sandals for this place is holy ground, verse 15. The commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, "Take your sandal off your foot, for the place where you stand is holy." And Joshua did that. Holy means set apart from God, okay? And so this is God's presence. He has set apart this little area of ground of where his presence is at that moment, and it's holy. It's set apart for the purposes of God. And so this removing of the sandals is a sign, scripturally we could see as a sign of respect and to show an attitude of humility. When it came to David, we read in 2 Samuel 15 as David flees before his son, Absalom. Zadok, the priest, shows up with the Ark of the Covenant willing to go with David. And so we read in verse 25, 2 Samuel 15, it's up here. It says, "The king said to Zadok, 'Carry the ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and show me both it and his dwelling place.'" And then it says in verse 30, as David leaves, it says this, "So David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives, wept as he went up, and he had his head covered and went barefoot." Shows humility. Shows being humble before God. A mourning process of sorts. In Ezekiel, we're told that Ezekiel is, he is told that his wife is going to die. And instead of doing the normal thing of mourning and being humble and taking off your shoes and putting, a sackcloth and ash on and things like that, he is told not to do that. Don't show humility. Don't show mourning. Why? Because you're going to be assigned to the people that they're not going to have time to do that themselves when they're taken captive and gone into Babylon. And so he tells them in verse 17 of Ezekiel 24, "Sigh in silence," meaning grieve in silence. "Make no mourning for the dead. Bind your turban on your head," look like you do every day, "and put your sandals on your feet." Show no mourning, show no humility. Interesting. It's also interesting when we go over the priestly garments in Exodus chapter 39. There's no mention of footwear. No mention of sandals or what kind of sandals you're supposed to use when you minister before the Lord, because you're not supposed to be wearing any sandals. You're supposed to be barefoot. In Exodus 28, 6 through 14, it speaks of the ephod that the high priest is going to wear. In Exodus 28, 15 through 30, the breastplate. Exodus 28, 31 through 35, the robe. The Exodus 28, 36 through 38, the turban. Exodus 28, 39, the linen tunic. But no mention of what to wear on your feet. It's interesting that when it comes to service there in the tabernacle or the temple, we're told that there's a laver to be placed just there in the courtyard before you enter into the holy place. And if you're a high priest, before you enter the holy place and then the holy of holies. And so the laver is placed outside of the entrance to these rooms. This laver contains water, which God commands the priest to use to wash their hands and feet before they enter into the holy place. Exodus 30, verse 17 through 21. Exodus 40, verse 30 through 32. Failure to do so will result in their death. Exodus 30, 20 through 21. In order to wash your feet, if you have some sort of footwear on, it would require you to remove that footwear, your sandals. In order to wash your feet, it wouldn't make any sense to wash your feet and then put on dirty sandals after that. So, you wash your feet and they're clean. Yes, you step down onto ground, but as was explained to me last service, as someone explained to me as they kind of dug into the Jewish thought behind this, it's because you're about to serve the Creator of the heavens and the earth. And so to be in touch with your Creator, you need to be in touch with your creation, with His creation. I thought that was interesting. Could quite possibly be. But we don't see remove a sandal before you wash your feet. They're just told to wash their feet. And it is interesting when you see any sort of drawings. When you go to Israel, you go to the Temple Institute and they show all these pictures of these priests serving and things, and they're all barefoot. They're all barefoot because there's no holy footwear per se in order to wear when you're serving the Lord in his tabernacle or temple. And so God is declaring this place where he's appearing, his presence set apart for his presence at that moment as holy. Take your shoes off. Take your shoes off. Verse 6, moreover, he said, Exodus 3, verse 6, moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Moses understands now. He's standing on holy ground. He's taking off his sandals. God continues to speak to him. And he says something very interesting that I had never seen before. But he says, I am the God of your father. Dave, we've been over this, you know, when he came to Jacob, he says, I'm the God of your fathers and Abraham, Isaac. Okay, but here it's in the singular. And I personally believe that this is God speaking to Moses about his biological father. Saying, Moses, just so you know, I am. And he still is. He wasn't I was. It's an I am thing. I am still the God of your father. Why? Because he's still alive. He's in the afterlife and he's doing just fine. I believe that would probably have been a comforting thing for Moses to hear. And by saying his father, it also means his mother and any other loved ones of his that believed in God. Okay. And he goes on and says, and the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Now, the interesting thing to me here is that this is what Jesus used to refute the Sadducees when they would come to him and say the whole idea of the resurrection is ridiculous. Because for the Sadducees, they only believed in the first five books of the Old Testament, the Pentateuch. Okay? So as they argued with the Pharisees because they would use other scriptures other than what they could find in the first five books of the Bible, the Sadducees are saying, well, we don't recognize those other books. Please show us in the first five books where there's a resurrection of the dead. And what does Jesus do? He goes right to it. Here, let me show you something in, well, one of the books you believe in. And by the way, it's the second book. It's called Exodus. And so he says in verse 31 of Matthew 22, but concerning the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was spoken to you by God saying? Notice what he says that. This has been spoken to you, Sadducees, by God. And this is what God is saying. I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And he just rebuked them. And pretty much 80% of what they're in disagreement with more than anything else with the rest of Judaism. Now, they also didn't believe in angels and all just different weird stuff. But it was really the resurrection of the dead was their sticking point of why they have to be more or less separate from the Pharisees and the rest of those who believed in Judaism. It's what really set them apart was this whole thing about the resurrection. And Jesus just comes and obliterates it. Just obliterates it. Because God is the God of the living. There is an afterlife. And those who put their faith in God through his son Jesus Christ today, guess what? You'll spend eternity with God. And you'll be part of the living. And I believe that this is given to Moses and for everyone else to understand that they're believing, you know, fathers and mothers and wives and sons and daughters and husbands that die in faith are doing just fine in the afterlife. God is very clear about this, and you should be clear on this as well. Verse 7 of Exodus says, chapter 3, verse 7, and the Lord said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and I've heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrow. Something, again, that I never saw before. This is the first time that God ever declares a people my people. This is the first time he declares to the children of Israel, I should say, as my people. It's amazing. And I've heard their cry. We're going to see in the next few verses here how much God himself says, I. Okay? I have seen their oppression. I know their sorrows. Verse 8, so I've come down. I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians. Who's going to deliver the people out of the hand of the Egyptians? God is going to do it. And to bring them up from the land to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me. I have also seen the oppression which the Egyptians oppressed them. So he says I several times here, shows the Lord's personal commitment to the remedy of their situation here. You have a crisis in verse 7. He repeats that crisis in verse 9, and he gives the remedy of it in verse 8, and he says he's the one that's going to do it. Now, at this point, Moses is probably going, yeah, awesome. This is great. This is awesome, you know. I find this also interesting. There's a bit of a hint here of nowhere does it say, and Moses, you're going to be part of this group that I take out and bring into the land flowing with milk and honey. Moses isn't mentioning that. Children of Israel, I've heard their cry. Those that are in bondage, I've heard their cry. I'm going to bring them out. I'm going to bring them into the land flowing with milk and honey. He doesn't say that to Moses. Now, quick little spoiler alert. Moses doesn't make it into the promised land. Okay. And the reason he doesn't is because, well, he misrepresented God. And Jesus says, too much is given, much is required. If you think for a moment, as you have been raised in a Christian home and be poured into the Christian faith, and you have a handle on the scriptures, and then you go sideways and decide, I'm not going to walk with God after all. If you think the person who has not had that kind of an upbringing is under the same, well, punishment structure as you, you're wrong. You wonder why that person who hasn't been poured in to the Lord Jesus Christ, the gospel, Christian upbringing, things like that, is able to go off and sin, and it seems like it doesn't really affect them, and they seem to actually be prosperous in it. But then you try and do it, and you're getting hammered. You're getting slammed. You are not able to be successful apart from God. Why is it? Because too much is given, much is required. That's why. And because you probably are a child of God, and God punishes his children. He doesn't punish those that aren't his kids. Satan will punish them enough not knowing Christ, okay? And so understand that. Well, Moses has been speaking to God face to face as a man speaks to his friend. He's been able to see all that God has done through his life. He's been able to see as he delivers the people out, as God used him to deliver the people out, all those amazing plagues. And I got to tell you, you can share with me all you want about Dave, the parting of the Red Sea. Dave, all those 10 plagues. Dave, when he smacks the rock and water comes out. Dave, those are all amazing. But I got to tell you something. If I could ask to do any of those things through the power of God, it would still be the staff. It would still be the staff throwing it down and have it turn into a snake. To me, that is the most amazing thing, to be able to do that, freak everybody else out in the room, and then just be able to pick it up and become a staff again. And then any other charlatan tries to do that and throws it down and becomes a snake, I just throw mine down and he eats it. And then I can pick it up again. That, to me, I'm telling you, I don't know if it's a guy thing or whatever, but I, prank city. You don't know when I'm coming, and I'm dropping that on your kitchen floor and just hearing you shriek and then picking up, it's just me, it's just Dave wanting to be Moses. That's all it is. That, to me, is the best. And he had that with him all the time. It never says he's not able to do that. It's never, does it say, and God took away that power to do that once they're out of the land. You know he was doing that for his grandkids and everybody else. He was throwing that down, picking it up, letting his kids shriek, and, you know, grabbing it again. It would have been the most awesome thing. And so he experiences all this, gets to the other side of the Red Sea. Not more than a day or two goes by, and the people are complaining, "I'm thirsty. When are we going to get something to drink? Are we there yet?" You know, that whole thing. And so God tells him, "I want you to smack the rock at Mount Horeb," and water comes gushing out to be able to fill this lake of the people. Now, many years later, like 38 years later, they're in the wilderness. The people are complaining about water again. God goes to Moses goes to God. God says, "Okay, I want you to speak to the rock this time, and then water's going to come out." But he goes before the people, and what does he do? He says, "You rebellious lot." And then he strikes the rock twice. Water came out, but God also told Moses, "Moses, shouldn't have struck the rock." Why? Because you messed up the metaphor that I was trying to show the people. What metaphor is that? Well, we're told in God's word that Christ is the rock. And Christ only needs to be struck once in order to provide living water. And Jesus came as the rock, and he was smote once upon the cross. And through that, what happens? Living water. Living water. But you had to hit it twice, mess up the whole metaphor, and guess what? Because of that, you don't get to go in the promised land. Too much is given, much is required. Much is required. And so they're going to be brought to this place flowing with milk and honey. The word honey there is a Hebrew word, davash, and it means honey or syrup. So this could be a honey made from bees, or it could be a syrup or honey made from fruit. If you go to Israel with us, you'll get to experience probably for your first time date honey. Now, you can get date honey at lots of different places now. You can order on Amazon from Israel and stuff like that, and it's great. You know, it's the same stuff. But 20 years ago, before you had Amazon and all that kind of stuff, you'd taste the stuff and go, "Where can I get this?" So you get all these jars of honey, and then you have to pray over to make sure it doesn't break, you know, in your bag on the way home, because then it no longer is a blessing. So, but this stuff is so good. I am telling you, those who've been to Israel, you know, you've tasted the date honey. It's amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. I love it. If I lived there, I would be like this. I would just be having it every single day on every piece of toast, bread, pancakes, whatever it is, and just taking shots left and right. This stuff is so good. It's absolutely amazing. And so it could be speaking of that, and it speaks of agriculture milk that you get from the goats and from the cows and such. And then it also speaks of bees because they pollinate everything, but it's also speaking of the fruit that they can make into jams and jellies as well as this syrup. So, and then there are six ethnic groups that are there inside the land of Canaan, small independent states. It's not an exhaustive list. But in most of the lists, when they give a summary of all these nations, it always ends with the land of the Jebusites. It seems to always be mentioned last, not in every single one. When it's talking about the topography of these nations, once or twice it's mentioned second to last. But of all the rest of them, it's always mentioned last. And it almost seems to be that Israel itself didn't settle until David defeated the Jebusites in Jerusalem and then made that his capital. And it seemed from then on, that's when Israel started to become a nation with the different 12 tribes. So, verse 10, it says in Exodus 3, verse 10, "Come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." So, Pharaoh here would be Amenhotep II. This is the Pharaoh of the Exodus. We'll talk a little bit more about him as we continue on. Up until this point, I'm pretty sure Moses, again, is very excited to hear all that the Lord is going to do. But now he is being told, "I'm going to do this through you. I'm going to send you to Pharaoh, and you're going to bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." This is the first that Moses is hearing it, and he's a little reluctant. He's a little reluctant. God is going to Moses as his human instrument, as God does with us. There's a lot of things that God wants to do here in Castle Rock, but he wants to do it through us. He wants to do it through us, his human instruments. Verse 11, "But Moses says to God, 'Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?' Some of you are saying that. Who am I to invite someone to a sunrise service? Who am I to invite someone to church? Who am I to buy a shirt that says I love my church? And when someone says, what do you love about your church? You should have an answer. And if you don't buy the shirt. Don't buy the shirt. And so he's a little reluctant here, okay? Because he knows he can't do it. He can't do it. Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? So he, God, said, I will certainly be with you. Do you need anything more than that? Certainly. The word certainly is Hebrew word ki. It means because or surely. The words I will be is actually one word in the Hebrew. It's hayah, means to be, become, come to pass. In other words, because of who God is, what has been spoken will come to pass. Certainly, surely, this will happen. Why? Because God is with you. And if you have God, you don't need any other. It's good enough. It should be good enough. And this shall be a sign to you that I've sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. Interesting thing about this sign. Usually a sign is given to show what God has said will come to pass. Usually the sign comes first. And then that gives you the confidence of knowing what he has said and the way that promise will come to pass. Here, it's different. It's an unusual sign. The sign is confirmed after Moses leads the people back out of Egypt. It is when Moses is back with the people of Israel worshiping, serving God on this mountain. That's where Moses is speaking here to God, that God is speaking to Moses here, that sign will be fulfilled. Moses is being called first to trust, obey God first in order to see this sign fulfilled. The sign mentioned here requires faithful obedience before it will become a reality. Yet, as we shall see, there will be many signs that go before this, but this is going to be the ultimate proof of Moses' divine calling, that when he shows up there at the mountain where God is speaking to him now, which is also known as Mount Sinai, that it's at that point, that's the ultimate proof that, for one, God has been with him and that he has truly been called to what it is that he has been called to do. Because we're going to see people challenging Moses every step of the way until they get to the base of the mountain and even afterwards. But because God says it's going to happen, it is. And when Moses gets there, there's going to be a change with him at that point as well. And he will have even more faith and confidence in God. Understand that when God calls you out of something, he calls you to something. Okay? He calls you from to for. Okay? So he calls you out of the world, out of Egypt, out of the place of bondage, into serving and worshiping the living God. And when you do that, that is when your life has purpose and meaning. And if you don't, it does not. Because it's vanity. And you've hooked yourself up to something that will never satisfy and will not continue on once you die. This is why it's so important to get out of the world into the Lord and to be used by God in the way of worship and serving the holy God. And then this next verse in 14... Or 13 and 14. We have to wait till next time. Let nothing ever separate us
from the holy love of God. This Friday edition of Abiding in the Word with Pastor Dave Love has come to a close. Don't miss Monday as we continue our study through Exodus. If you're in Castle Rock or the surrounding area, we'd love to have you visit. You'll find us right near the actual Castle Rock on the corner of 5th and Woodlands. Our weekend services are Saturdays at 5 p.m. and Sundays at a new time of 8:30 a.m. as well as 11 a.m. High schoolers will meet during the 8:30 service and junior high students during the 11 a.m. service. Childcare is available during all our weekend services. We also have a midweek study on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. At the same time, our kids ministry runs Awana. And for young adults, our Arise ministry meets every Friday night at 6:30, right here at the church. For more information about us or this radio ministry, please visit our website at calvarycr.com or download our free mobile app from the Apple App Store or Google Play. You can also call the church office at 303-663-2514. We appreciate you spending time with us today. Until our next time together, we encourage you to always be abiding in the Word of God.